Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday afternoon, 6th September 1978. We've got a very good bunch of questions here. And as a matter of fact, right through the week we've had very good questions, which is a very good sign indeed. All true Buddhist teachings emphasize, and you have also mentioned it in your talks, that any rejection will cause suffering. In your book, The Heart of Religion, you say, if I reject various aspects of my social, cultural, and especially my religious conditioning, because I see that the ways of life to which I conformed are harmful or foolish or hypocritical, because I see better, more humane, refined and skillful ways, because I see that the beliefs I held have no warrant in truth, and the rituals I performed are but superstitious mummery or a travesty of virtue, I shall have to suffer on account of such rejection. What I am rejecting has roots in my psyche, strong or weak, according to the extent of my conditioning. My new outlook, even if truer or more advanced, clashes with the conditioning I am rejecting, and this conflict brings pain. Rejection on the surface level is obvious and understandable, but I don't think that I have quite seen before how deep-rooted and far-reaching the results of our rejection are. This is not really a question, but I should be grateful if you would say a few more words on this aspect. You see, we live in society. The basic society, since we are born, is the family itself. We are conditioned by what our parents believe and teach and practice. We are conditioned by the ways of life and behavior of the family and of our particular community and so on. We are conditioned by our teachers and all the rest of it. And as long as we conform to what everybody else is doing, we are accepted as, in terms of, oh, he is one of us. Now, the moment there comes a variation from that, which is fairly radical or sufficiently strong, or which somehow offends a certain number of members of our particular society, then, whether they like to show it or not, there is in their own psyche a reaction against us, a certain non-acceptance. Also, the very fact that I have rejected certain things which formed my conditioning raises up inner conflict. The very cells of the body are conditioned from the time we are born. Our heredity itself bears, our personal heredity bears throughout the cells of the whole physical body the effects of that conditioning, of our socio-cultural heritage. It impresses itself upon the cells, particularly through the brain and nervous system, and the activity of the ductless glands, and this constitutes us in whatever social order we are born, whatever cultural situation we are in, that has impressed us very strongly. So, when we try to depart from that, when we reject it in any way or any form, within ourselves, in our whole being, there is set up this conflict. You see? And this is why, even if through personal growth, personal vision, seeing things more truly, even if I do that, then to reject what is actually constitutive of me is going to cause pain and suffering. You see? And of course, there is the conflict with society. He is not one of us. So, although whatever we put forward, which is different, which is not in conformity, however better it may actually be, will cause us suffering as part of the consequence of our not just rejection in the sense of pure rejection as against acceptance, but even because we have actually outgrown the backward stage. That is why the good man has to suffer for the sins and the drawbacks of his society. Actually, he's doing good, as we call it. He's progressing. But there is this reaction. Oh, he's not like us. And therefore, we have to bear with that. Now, the mistake that most of us make when we do have a better insight and would like to bring about a change which is actually for the good of society, we are made to suffer for it. I think that's about all I can add to what is already in the book. Now here we have a very practical question. Could you answer for us how we can become beware of spiritual pride? Well, take care of the words you use. To beware means to be on guard against. This attitude of being on guard against whatsoever is wrong or evil has been inculcated through the ages in us. Parents, teachers, friends, society, everything, you see, to be on guard against. Now this is a somewhat short-sighted view, because whenever you are on guard against, you are conscious of the self as subject, separate from and in conflict with the object. Now this conflict doesn't help one, really. Sometimes it raises up more trouble than if one merely conformed. So, we have to learn to become aware in the right sense, in the fully transformative sense, which means that the self, the isolative self-consciousness of ourselves as the subject, considering being aware of the object which we are observing, you see, that isolative self-consciousness has to be out of the situation. Then only there is true awareness and true observation. So the attitude of being on guard is not the best possible attitude. One has to approach it with as complete attentiveness as possible. When attentiveness is total and complete, the isolative aspect of self-consciousness is out of the situation. Therefore, as a result of that kind of attentiveness, there is no temporary solution of the problem. Now, in a very subtle way, when we practice and study, the question goes on, the very attempt merely increases our feeling of egotistical self-importance and gratification. Because we are conscious of ourselves as the subject in an isolative manner. It is this isolativeness which interferes with the wholeness of the observation. It never is true observation. It is a conditional observation. Now, this ties up with another question which we have here. Would it be true to say that one of the great obstacles to the flow of transcendence through the organism is fear? Fear in all its aspects, anxiety of the unknown, even the fear of transformation itself. If we could really see fear for what it is and come to terms with it, would not our path towards reality be straighter and clearer? Now, yes, fear plays one of the most powerful parts in our whole developmental process. Right from our animal ancestry, we derive this ingrained fear, being on guard against all dangers for the sake of our survival. The animal has all, the whole of the animal kingdom has it. And this body of ours is derived from a primordial animal ancestor and bears all that heredity within itself. The sense of fear. Now, as you say, the fear of in all its aspects, anxiety, the fear of the unknown, even the fear of transformation itself. The fear is there because one wonders, how shall I be able to deal with the difficulties of life which surround me if I add another difficulty in terms of myself changing? You see, fears like that come up. And if we could really see fear for what it is and come to terms with it. Now, no, not come to terms with it. Not strive to overcome it, fight against it. Not sign a peace treaty with it and say, all right, fear, you go so far and let me go so far free and so forth. It cannot be done that way. One has to face that fear completely in its totality. Become free of being aware in terms of I am afraid. We will all naturally start that way, of course. It's impossible to avoid it. I am afraid. But then look at it steadily, not as an object outside yourself merely, but as actually constituting the me. All these qualities fear, courage, generosity, cruelty, kindness, all these qualities actually constitute the psyche. That is the me. You see? And if a sense of myself as subject, looking at the thing and holding it outside myself in order to look at it is present, if that is present, then there will always be fear standing by, so to say, ready to pounce upon me. That fear is me. I am that fear, psychically. But don't be conscious of it in terms of I am. You will come to the point when you will be able to see this is fear. And when you see this is fear and continue to look at it as such, you will become conscious in terms of all mankind, all life suffering from fear. And if one looks at it steadily, unflinchingly, not antagonistically, not trying to come to terms with it or anything, you will find that your observation is really pure observation. The brain now, the brain comes into play. It is in one of those rare situations where it is in an unconditioned state. And because it is unconditioned, the understanding of fear becomes complete and total. And in that total understanding, there is the dissolution of the psychical energy in us which expresses itself as fear, and its resolution into pure psychical energy, free of fear. And you know, if mindfulness, this is real mindfulness and real observation, if this can be done with respect to any one difficulty, the whole lot of difficulties disappear out of the psyche. Why? Because we have released the power of transcendence, the sense of transcendence fills the psyche with pure light, which enables us to be aware of the wholeness of existence in a very real way. As a matter of course, all the time, we haven't to strive to realize wholeness. It is just there. The psyche is pure. It becomes empty of all the ambivalent forms of psychical energy, love, hate, kindness, cruelty, generosity, meanness, and so forth and so forth. This is how the purification of the psyche takes place. Not by getting rid of this, that, and the other because our teacher says that it is undesirable, or because I see that it is a vice or something like that, and I must cultivate a virtue. Our virtue and vice disappear at once. If I say I must cultivate a virtue, it means that I know what virtue is. Do I? I certainly know what vice is. But do I know what virtue is? When I say to myself, that was a virtuous action on my part, it was a kind action, a helpful action, you see, my imperfect mind, because I am not yet the enlightened one, is misinterpreting the extent of that particular psychical manifestation, and I call it a virtue. But that is not real virtue. Real virtue is transcendent, is transcendent. In the Rig Veda, they represented virtue in terms of the god Varuna, the moral governor of the universe, the absolute good. Now that absolute good, of course, is indefinable. Obviously indefinable. If I could define it, then I would bring it down to my little confined, limited level, and therefore it would cease to be transcendent, it would cease to be universal, it would cease to be real soul strength, spiritual strength, virtus, the Latin virtus, and the word vir is man, a man. See? So it's all a question of the art of observing, the art of being mindful, not merely looking at the thing cold-bloodedly. We start that way. We have to start that way. Then let it come inwards and let the feeling aspect of observation play its part. The warm feeling aspect, which will intensify the observational power. When these two are fully integrated and the sense of I as a separate subject is out of the situation, and I am able to see all the reactions that go out of my brain in the act of observing, I see the whole thing fully and completely, then the brain is, during that period, in the unconditioned state. And in that unconditioned state, the miracle takes place. The water is turned into wine, if you like. And there, or if you would like to put it in purely Buddhistic terms, there is that turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. So, this applies to the problem of spiritual pride just as much as this other question applies to the problem of fear. And when fear is gone, and remember that the fifth Dhyani Buddha, Amoghasiddhi, is the all-accomplishing one, and his gesture is the gesture of fearlessness, the Abhaya Mudra of fearlessness. The great teachers, like the Buddha, the perfected holy ones, were fearless. They were not afraid whether they were walking through a jungle infested with wild beasts or not. They were not afraid of robbers or murderers. There is that wonderful account of the robber, that murderous robber, Angulimali. And the Buddha is walking along, you see, and Angulimali says to himself, "Ah, here is another victim for me." And the Buddha walks along quite steadily and fills his mind with metta and karuna and spreads the radiance of that psychical power of pure loving kindness and compassion. And Angulimala tries to catch up with him and so forth, and he can't. Read that account, it is most instructive. And then the two converse, and the end is that Angulimala, the murderous robber, becomes one of his great disciples. And I must say the end of the story, when King Pasenadi, King Pasenadi visits the Buddha, and he says, and the talk turns on this robber Angulimala, and after a few words, the Buddha says to the king, "There is Angulimala, whom you are looking for." You see, to have him up before the judge for punishment and so forth. and the king's hair stands on end with fear. And the Buddha says, do not fear. He's a different person now. Very instructive, wonderful these accounts are. Now, good. You have talked about the necessity to have a rightly trained body to withstand the archetypal forces. Also, the absolute necessity for purification and a fit and strong nervous system. Is the frequent occurrence of neuroses today due to an inflow of these forces before the being is fully prepared? In other words, can a person who is very sensitive, highly strung, and psychically developed but otherwise unprepared receive an inflow of this force without having sought to bring it about? Now, let us look at it again. You have talked about the necessity to have a rightly trained body to withstand the archetypal forces. It would be better to formulate it this way: the necessity to have a rightly trained body to be able to absorb the inflow or the influx of archetypal forces. To withstand generally means to be up against, but you're not being, we don't have to be up against the great archetypal energies as such, but to be able to absorb them and not be shattered by them. Also, the absolute necessity for purification and a fit and strong nervous system. Yes, of course, that goes without saying. That's the whole purpose of all the physical discipline in all the religious systems as such. Take, for example, the very simple, straightforward physical discipline of mindful walking, as we say. This is part of the physical process of so training the body that it will remain sensitive, awake, and helpful, therefore, to true mindfulness. Or discipline with respect to food. In the hot countries, one meal in the middle of the day apparently proves ideal for one's purposes, to keep the body in the right condition. Perhaps in a climate like this, two meals a day should be sufficient. But I think that apart from brunch and tupper, all the little extras and accessories and so forth become accessories before and after the crime of overeating. Now, is the frequent occurrence of neuroses today due to an inflow of these forces before the being is fully prepared? Well, of course, neuroses can occur because of that. They occur less often, I should imagine, because archetypal forces are affecting you, than for many other reasons, above all, because of sense indulgence. All forms of sense indulgence. Not the right use of the senses, but the deliberate indulgence of the senses through the passion for such enjoyment, the greed for sensational excitements. That is why one gets upset mainly. Now, the right use of the senses means definitely the complete use of the senses, not suppressing the functioning of the senses. For instance, in one of the suttas, the Buddha says, I forget to whom he is talking, he says, but I do eat curries, nicely savored foods, and enjoy every morsel, and I note mindfully exactly what it is, and so forth. He utilizes his sense of taste fully, but he does not cling to it. He does not get attached to this, that, or the other food. If there is some food which is distasteful or not so very good, he observes, fully observes, yes, this food is such and such. You see? It's like that. Then there is wise discrimination. The Dhyani Buddha Amitabha coming into play. Wise discrimination as to what to select, what not to select, and so forth. Now there you've got the right use of the senses. If you go to a concert and are listening to a wonderful performance, Karajan with the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven or something like that, you see. Listen with your whole being, but remain completely poised. Let it be a pure listening. And listen externally to the sounds which penetrate to the brain through the ear, and listen to the sounds inwardly which will act like a mantra. If you listen that way, wholly, completely, with no interference by the brain, oh, this was not quite so well played as when Tempera conducted it or Bruno Walter conducted it. Oh, I wish it could have been like this. If you do that, you have spoilt the whole thing. And the transformation from within doesn't take place. But let the listening be a pure, a whole, a complete listening, and transcendence itself will come through into your being in its particular archetypal form of energy and effect transformation of your inner consciousness. Do remember, there is no such thing as coming to the end of the story and reaching a stage and like the snail which managed to creep up this greasy pole somehow and then sticks there forever. It will have to come down for feeding itself. You see, don't think in those terms. There is constant growing, constant developing. Remember I mentioned yesterday, the Buddha goes away from home at 29. At 35, he is the enlightened one. And he gives his teaching. But when he is 51, he gives out in greater detail in the profundity of the teaching of Shunyata, and so forth. So you see, there is continual growth, and this growth is in a transcendental sense, therefore it is immeasurable. It is in terms of the infinite. The brain can't conceive that sort of thing. How can the infinite become more infinite? Or the absolutely wonderful become more wonderful? It is already that. And yet, in a mysterious way, at its own transcendent level, that is transcendent for us, transcendent in relation to us, there is this continuous growth which never stops. That's the marvel and miracle of existence. And the special marvel in connection with the human kingdom. your animal can't do that. But you and I can. Because in mind and consciousness, we can outgrow, completely outgrow, all the limitations imposed upon our vision and understanding by the limitations of the psychophysical organism. This is the marvel about man. And there you find the real meaning of man coming in from man, the Sanskrit verb manyate, which inevitably has to be translated that way, to think. But this thinking at the transcendental level is creation itself. The theists have always put it in these terms, and God said, or God minded, or God created, and it was. But concentrate attention upon God minded light, and there was light. Mind is this mysterious creative energy, this manifestation, particular type of manifestation of creative energy, which produces the cosmos, the mystery of life, the mystery of being, and so forth. Everything comes out of that. So neuroses may come, but that doesn't mean that one should stop developing. Keep on growing, keep on growing, and observe very carefully. Observe minus the self-conscious subject as being different. This is the great difficulty. The intensity of the observation will save the observation from becoming my observation. Then there is this marvelous thing which is pure mindfulness. You notice how in the when there is anything said about the deep jhanas, the absolute purity of mindfulness, complete purity of mindfulness. You see? In other words, can a person who is very sensitive, highly strung, etc., but otherwise unprepared, receive an inflow of this force without having sought to bring it about? Don't seek to bring about an inflow of archetypal energies. We have quite enough to do dealing with the actual energies which are operating in our little sphere. Archetypal energies cannot be stopped from affecting each and every one of us in any case. They are always operative, they are always present. When we breathe in, as we say, air, which is mainly a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen, plus various other gases. All right. Well, where do we breathe that oxygen and nitrogen from? Our immediate environment. Out of the air immediately around us. But the air immediately around us is dependent for its oxygen and nitrogen and so forth upon the tremendous amount of air that is available for us. All the air which surrounds the whole earth. So you see, that is constantly affecting the air in our particular environment. If that were not available, the inexhaustible reservoir were not available, our air here would soon be exhausted, and well, you know what happened in that account known as the black hole of Calcutta. You see? It's like that, isn't it? So these transcendent forces are constantly operating. We have to prepare ourselves, and then as they operate more and more upon us, more intensely, there is constant replenishment for us in our little psychological way and in terms of our consciousness, there is replenishment and there is what we call spiritual food, spiritual energy supplied all the time. I think there is one more question here. Would you please describe the power of a mantra by taking us through it sound by sound? Can a mispronounced mantra have a different effect from one pronounced correctly? And would it not be so effective? And would it be not so effective in raising a in raising power, in releasing power? I will deal with the latter part straight away. Can a mispronounced mantra have a different effect from one pronounced correctly? All right. Take one of the very famous mantras which that prince of yogis, Yajnavalkya, imparted to the disciple Bharadvaja. The mantra which goes Om Namo Narayanaya. All right, say it 100,000 times and see what happens. Say it 1,000,000 times, 10,000,000 times. You won't live that long to say it. But just see, is there any result? You can teach a parrot to say it. Is there any result? Not at all. It has to be intoned correctly. But this correct intonation is something which is specifically taught by one who is already past master in the art. And he will not teach it to anyone who hasn't already developed sufficiently far as to be able to enter the profound states of consciousness, whether they be in Upanishadic terms or in the Buddhistic terms, the various jhanas and still deeper, the samapatis. The samapatis are the universal correspondent of the jhanas as such. I have mentioned just this one mantra, Om Namo Narayana, Om Mani Padme Hu is another such mantra, and so forth. But don't play with fire or attempt to play with fire. When can the mantra be rightly used? Only when you yourself are able to enter these profound states and are beyond any personal need for the use of the mantras. I have said so often that the scriptures really come to life when you, if you read them after you have understood and grown. Then the words of scripture are living energies. Not till then. Otherwise they are mere words. Mainly. Why? Because the read word, the heard word, the spoken word is interpreted by me, the imperfect, limited person with the imperfect, constricted mind in my little way. Am I able to take in the richness of the content and the tremendous import of the inner significance of what the perfected Holy One says when I hear his words? I'm only making a very bad photograph. My hand is shaking, the camera is not up to much, and there we are. There is a distorted photograph, and that is all. I am limited here. But as and when the mind is perfected, the psyche is completely cleansed in every way, then, because I can enter the deep states, and having entered the deep states, I then pronounce the mantra. Not till then. When I pronounce the mantra then, there's a tremendous influence extending over a vast area around one. So, it's no use my trying to take any mantra word by word and go through it sound by sound, because in the first place I just don't know myself how to pronounce these mantras. I don't enter the profound states of consciousness that the perfected holy ones can enter. I haven't got that capacity at all. Yet. So you see, I would be a little bit of a charlatan if I were to pretend that pronounce the mantra this way or that way. Beware of all that. Beware. If you're carrying an atom bomb with you, you know the dangers.